by employees on the Urbana-Champaign campus, help support 11 social service agencies and other nonprofit organizations. Information on how to give and how your donations will help our community is on the web at www.ccfd.uiuc.edu.
Welcome back to the second hour of Focus 580. This is our morning telephone talk show. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Producing the program, Harriet Williams and Martha Deal, and Jason Croft is at the controls this morning. In this second hour of the show, we'll be talking with Alice Fulton. She is a poet, has published a number of collections of her work, and has received many awards for her writing, among them the Rebecca Johnson Bobbitt National Prize for Poetry from the Library of Congress. This she received for her collection Felt, which is published in 2001. This is a work, an award that's given out in recognition of the most distinguished book of poetry written by an American and published during the preceding 2 years, so every 2 years. Her most recent book is a collection of work that had been previously published over a number of years, so in one volume you can get a sense of her work over time. That's titled Cascade Experiment, and it was published by W.W. Norton last year. She teaches English as a member of the faculty at Cornell University and is here visiting the campus of the University of Illinois. Her visit here is sponsored by the English Department's MFA Creative Writing Program. Throughout the academic year, they bring writers here to the campus to give the students an opportunity to talk with them. And we've been lucky enough to have a number of these people on the show here to talk a little bit about writing and about poetry. And we're pleased that Alice Fulton could be here and spend some time with us this morning talking about poetry and her work. She'll read some things for us. And also, I want to make sure that I mention that for people who are in and around Champaign-Urbana, she'll be doing a reading this afternoon at 5 o'clock at the Author's Corner at the Illini Union Bookstore down on the campus. And, of course, anybody who's around town here who would be interested should feel welcome to stop by and meet her and hear more from her. And, of course, here on the program, too, questions welcome. People want to call in. 333-9455 is the number. We also do have a toll-free line, and that's good anywhere that you can hear us, 800-222-9455. So at any point here, if you want to join the conversation, you should feel welcome to do that. Thanks very much for being here.
Thank you, David. It's a pleasure to be here.
I know that you do other kinds of writing in addition to poetry. You've written and published stories and also essays. But primarily, I guess, you are a poet, thought of as being a poet.
That's what I've done most.
What about that form, as opposed to other kinds of writing, do you find appealing?
I think it's the openness of it, for one thing, that anything can go in a poem. If you write a story, you know, you have characters and you have to think about narrative and so on. But anything that one is interested in can go into a poem, whether it's science or art or really anything in the world. So it's very open. And at the same time, it's compressed and distilled. And I like the way that it's an attempt to try to say things memorably and freshly. I always loved poetry, so for me to write it was to discover that I could do that was amazing.
Mm-hmm. At what point did you really intend that to be a focus? Was that when you went to college?
I started before I went to college. I started probably in high school writing poems and reading poetry. I was reading Emily Dickinson, and I would actually was a very bad student in high school. I'd cut classes and go to the library and read poetry, write poetry. Not a good example. But that's what I did. And then when I went to Empire State College, the only college that would take me, my grades were so bad in high school, my first class was Women Poets that I had chosen to take, and I loved it. I tried to get everybody in the class to write poetry. I was sort of a cheerleader. Let's all write a poem. And so I was just beginning that way, and then I was on the radio, actually. I was doing radio and radio announcer, putting myself through college, and I said over the air, I played Poetry Man by Joan Armatrading, and I mentioned I've dedicated it to the poets who had read the night before at a reading I'd been to, and they called me and said, would you like to be in our workshop, you know, or come, you know, visit us? We have a literary magazine. And then I was in a wonderful workshop, and people helped me write better poems, and one thing just led to another. I became obsessed. I loved it. I became more interested in poetry rather than less interested, so I kept going.
Yeah. Poetry at its best, I think, is a very musical thing, and I think particularly that's something, to me at least, in your work, I find attractive and very very present thing. And it's interesting, I guess, just based on the few things that I have read about you, that you are very much interested in music. So perhaps not surprising that maybe a little bit more than some of its work that I've read, there really is a lot of music in the work.
Well, thank you. Yeah, I love music and poetry. It's I think poetry really is language trying to be music without melody. It's doing it with meter and the sounds and so on. And I always wanted to be a singer. That was really my fantasy, but I couldn't sing, and I never had any musical talent. So I did what I could with language, making that the instrument. And that's a great compliment. I think it's so important to have that musical quality in language.
I think even in your work, I think almost to the point where I have yet to hear you read, and I'm really looking forward to that. But in reading the poems and I guess I must confess that as a reader, I am one of those people who seems to be reading it to myself. As I'm reading it, I can hear myself reading, and that there, in some of the work, it seems that the musicality of it is so much that I'm almost distracted by it. I'm almost distracted from the meaning. I get so caught up in the musicality of it, which I suppose either can be a good thing or a bad thing.
Yeah, I mean, I like that about poetry. That's one of the things I like about it, when the words are so beautiful that you get to the meaning as a secondary part of it. You're sort of seduced by the way it sounds, and then the meaning kicks in later. But what gets you first to read it again is, I think, the music and the sounds, and it's just such a beautiful use of language. If you think of Dickinson, for example, you don't always know what she meant when she wrote some of those great lines, but they're so intriguing and beautiful to listen to that you want to think about it. You want to stay with it and be with it for a while.
Is that something that you have to deliberately work at, or is that something that's just sort of comes and that's just the way that it works for you?
Well, I think it's a little bit of both, that some people have a natural ability, probably most people, to put together words that sound good, and rhyme is fun for kids even. So there's a lot of just natural ability in most people, but then you begin to do it more consciously because you love it, and beginning to collect words and really work on it and make it more conscious when you play with words. Mm-hmm. So it's a craft as well as a natural ability.
Why don't I ask you to read something here? We've been chatting for a little bit, and I'm sure that people who are listening would like to hear something. So,
okay, I'll read a sonnet. You know, it's old, really old. I wrote this a long time ago when I was living in New York City, and like most sonnets, it has 14 lines, and it's about friendship. Very simple topic, but one that I've returned to again and again. It's called What I Like. Friend, the face I wallow toward through a scrimmage of shut faces. Arms like tow ropes to haul me home. Aide-mémoire, my lost childhood docks, a bottled ark in harbor. Friend, I can't forget how even the word contains an end. We circle each other in a scared bolero, imagining stratagems, postures and impostures. Cold convictions keep us solo. I a hem and hedge my affections. Who'll blow the first kiss? Land it like the life forces we feel ticking at each wrist? It should be easy, easy to take your hand, whisper down this distance, labeled hers or his. What I like about you is.
That's a very old form. People have been writing sonnets for a long time.
Yes.
And it's good to know that people still are.
Yeah.
There are, in this particular collection, there are poems that take many different forms. How do you decide, or at what point do you decide, as you're thinking about what the poem's going to be about and what kind of sort of things that you would like to put in it, what sort of structure works best for what it is you're wanting to say?
That's a really good question. Sometimes I have so much to say that I know it could never fit in 14 lines, and I don't want to cut it short, especially as my work went on. It got longer, and it got more narrative. And I was interested in including different things, allowing it to wander. And instead of pushing a thought away when I was writing a poem, thinking that might be the most interesting thought, and if I push it away, the poem's going to be less honest, less authentic, less complex, and less true to the emotion that I'm going for. So when I let in more, they got longer and the form changed. And then I had to think about how to keep it formed in some sense and keep the music. And I've tried different creative ways of doing that, different one-of-a-kind ways of trying to get it to be longer but still have form and music.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that I read about you is that as you sort of go along through life, you collect things. Perhaps they're words, perhaps they're phrases, perhaps they're ideas, and that you have a notebook and that you actually, as you go along, if something occurs to you, you stumble across it, you sort of note it down and save these little bits, the idea being that those could be the building blocks and the pieces that sometime later you can do something with.
Exactly. I mean, I would say to the writers out there and people who are just beginning their writing, that's the single most important thing that you can do, is to start a notebook and create your own world in the notebook and just listen and write down whatever is interesting from your reading or from what eavesdropping, what people say, and contemporary English is so interesting, the way it's changing. I even tell students to make their own dictionary. And just to write down words that are their favorite words that they want to use in their poems. If you think of Dickinson again, she used these words that other poets have never used very much, like circumference. I mean, who would think a circumference would be a great word? But she made it her own. Experiment was another Dickinson word, and amplitude. So I think people find their own vocabularies, and their work takes on an original texture that way. But it's doable if you have a notebook, and then you always feel accompanied. You're never alone, and you're never starting with a blank page, which is, of course, frightening. Mm-hmm. You have this source that you can go to and draw upon, and suddenly it's a lot easier and more fun.
Yeah, and I think that's it's interesting to hear that, and that just what you just said about how frightening the blank page is. And because, again, I think that probably, particularly when it comes to poetry, that people have this idea that it's divinely inspired. It's like the apple that drops down out of the tree that clocks you on the head. You think, oh, a poem, and then you sit down and you write it. And of course, it's a deliberate craft, and it's a matter of putting things together, and it may take some time to gestate, and then once you get it down on the page, you may spend a lot of time changing things and moving things around until you finally get to the point where you look and you say, okay, I think that's finished, and I've done to it what I can do, and then from there you go on to something else.
Right, you sound just like a poet.
Oh,
you
no.
do. Well, of course, there are different aesthetics, and different people do it different ways. So there are people, for example, Allen Ginsberg. One of his favorite sayings was "first word, best word," and it was very much about spontaneity for him. Sort of the splat, you know, you throw it on the canvas theory, and it worked for him, obviously. Mm-hmm. But a lot of people feel, just as you say, and I do, that I like to go back and work at it and let it gestate and see what's there to be found and try to make it better than it was when it first occurred to me. And it isn't just divine inspiration. There's really more of a craft and patience involved. Yeah. I think the first thing is really love of language. I would say that the difference between a poet and maybe other sorts of writing is really poets get obsessed with language. And anyone who wants to be a poet, it isn't so much what they want to say. You know, because everyone has things to say. Everybody has a life. Everybody has a history and good things to say. It's that they love language. And so they become able to say it because of that obsession. They become able to say it in a more interesting, original way.
Yeah. I do also like the idea of keeping the notebook, though, because I know I have been myself in the past been a big eavesdropper. And people say the most amazing and wonderful stuff. And you can, and if you don't write it down, you're going to lose it. And so many times I have had that experience to hear somebody say something and think, that's so great. If I was writing a novel, I would want to steal that. And I don't want to put it in there. So I guess the way that you make sure that you do get those things is that if you have that idea, you have that little thing, you come across it, you hear someone saying, you better write it down right then. Or else you'll lose it and you'll wish that you had it later on.
I can give an example if you like. I don't know if I should read the poem, but there was a poem I wrote again. It's in my first book. I wrote it when I lived in New York. I went to a party and a woman was talking about how she had been to the Gucci store and she had asked them to show her a briefcase, and they showed her a briefcase made of plastic or vinyl, which is hard to believe, but they did.
In the Gucci store?
I know. But And so she came out with a great line that I thought was something I should write down. She said, "I never let anything touch me that wasn't once alive." And I thought, I have to go home and work that in. So I just was writing a poem, and I managed to work that into it. But
That's the Diamond Stud
exactly.
poem, isn't it?
My gosh,
yes.
Yes, the last line of a poem called My Diamond Stud.
Yeah.
And I won't read the whole thing, but the ending of the poem is, "For our tryst we'll go to travel folder heaven and buff puff each other's calluses in Valentine tubs." And I got that image of buff puffing. I just happened to have the TV on, and there was an ad for buff puff. And Valentine tubs was the Poconos in Pennsylvania, where they had
the
commercials for the heart-shaped
tubs.
And there I was, taking notes, writing the poem. And then it goes on, "He'll swindle the black heart between my thighs, dress me up in ultra suede sheaths, himself in naga hide. No, leather. He'd never let anything touch him that wasn't once alive." So I kind of took that from the party. And also, I was living near Studio 54, and there's a part in the poem that says, "Yes, he'll be a hitchhiker at this roller rink I frequent. My diamond stud who wheel up shedding sparks and say, écoute, baby, I'm a member of a famous folded trapeze act, etc." And that all came from Studio 54, living near the discotheque. And
that's a wonderful, I love that. That's a wonderful line. Would never wear any, and have anything touch his skin that wasn't once alive.
And that was just a gift. I mean, someone just said that. And people say things all the time. And more recently, I noticed my students especially saying, instead of "he said" or "she said," they'll say "he goes" or "she goes." It's very common. Mm-hmm. But I thought, what could I do with that in a poem? Instead of "he said" or "she said." So I use that in the poem too. "He goes, she goes." And I use it to sort of mean transients, or they're ephemeral, they're on their way out, they're leaving, going in that other sense as well as saying.
Yeah.
So, I mean, English is full of all this good stuff, and I try to steal as much of it and use it for my own wicked purposes.
Well, and that also suggests one of the wonderful possibilities about words is that they can mean more than one thing, and you can get different levels of meaning, and also depending on what words you place next to them. And this gets me at the idea of something that I don't want to get, real technical or make it sound like I know more about poetry than I do, but something that you do in your work that I think is particularly interesting is the way the lines break, and the fact that you can read one line as a line, and it'll tell you one thing, and particularly the final word or words will say something. But then when you hook them up with the beginning of the next line, you get a second sort of thing. So it causes you to consider that at least two different, you could be saying at least two different things, and maybe more than a couple things.
Exactly. Gosh, you picked up on that. That's so wonderful. That's something that I've tried for with the sense of the line, to give more meanings, just as you say. So it's enjambment. And a friend of mine, Christiane Miller, has a term for it, syntactic doubling, meaning that when you get to the end, it does these two things. You get one meaning when you read the line, and then you connect it to the next line. And as you say, it completely reverses, or you get a second meaning. Mm-hmm. So it's really a wonderful sense of what language can do and the depth of it. I don't know if I have a... Well, here's an example. I do it so much that... That story, that rock, I don't know if that's really the best example. I'm looking down at the page here. If I could find one in this poem that would be an example.
Well, you do that a lot, and so I'm sure at some point you can find an example.
And
I'll tell you
stop.
What. Well, you think about that.
Okay.
Let me reintroduce you to anybody who might have, because there might be some folks who have just joined us in the last 10 or 15 minutes since the time we started. Our guest this morning, Alice Fulton. She's professor of English at Cornell University. She's a poet, has published a number of collections of her work. The most recent brings together work that had previously been published over a number of years, so you can get a sense of how her writing has changed over time. That book is Cascade Experiment. It was published by W.W. Norton last year, so you can head out to the bookstore and look for it if you like. In fact, she'll be giving a reading at the Illini Union Bookstore this afternoon at 5 in the Author's Corner. So if you're interested, you can stop by. She has received a number of honors and awards for her work, has been widely published. She's here visiting as a part of the English Department's MFA Creative Writing Program, where periodically throughout the school year they bring writers and poets here so that students can have a chance to meet with them and talk with them about their work. And we're pleased that she could be here with us. Have you found...
I've been staring at the page looking for a good example. I can think of one from another poem, but okay. I have to find it. It's probably not the best example either. You don't want to overdo that kind of effect. Mm-hmm. So because if you do, it gets too gimmicky and tricky. But there's a sequence I wrote called Give, and someone pointed out a poem in it that does that very thing, and my hand is right on it here. So, nope. I thought it was, but it's not. Give. This is a sequence that takes the myth by Ovid and reimagines it in a present-day scenario, and it has an Elvis imitator in it and a sort of Frank Sinatra clone, because in Ovid's metamorphosis, people get to change into other forms, and Daphne is the one who changes into a tree. And instead of letting her just change into a tree, I had her change into other things along the way. I had her change into an electron, and she changes into light. I think I'm not finding it. I knew this would happen. Let's see. Here's something. Okay. This is from a poem, Vanishing Cream, but I don't know if I can find exactly that effect. TV rules. It must be visual Velcro at 4 grand per second. Show them what they've never seen before. Show the package to change brand preference. Show the product in use. Well, it's not exactly what you were talking about, David, but three lines there break with show. And actually, yes, it's the verb to show, but also, of course, I'm talking about TV shows, so you kind of get an emphasis on the show. Mm-hmm. And there are other examples of that syntactic doubling in this one. Don't know that I can find it. Sorry.
Well, that at least illustrates the point. And this must be something that, and particularly thinking about that and where you break from one line to the next, that must be something that takes a lot of time and work and working with. But that's not the kind of thing that's just going to happen.
Right.
Take some work to achieve that effect.
That's true. And yeah, there's so many things you can do with the line as a poet. I mean, the example I just read where the lines end with the word show is subtle, but it reinforces what you're writing about. And I was saying to a student the other day that instead of beginning the line on a prepositional phrase, a small word like of, you can kind of front-load the line with a muscular word, a noun or a verb, and then the whole poem kind of tips to the left of the page because you've got all the heavy words on the left side of the page, and you get that front-loaded line sense. And there's so many ways. You can have a jagged sense of the line at the beginning of the line, jagged right sense of the line where everything gets sort of jagged on the end and the reader is jerked forcibly to the next line. It's all very subtle and sort of almost subconscious effects on the reader. But I do believe that it does have an effect when people pause at the end of the line.
We have someone who clearly is listening on the internet because they're in Philadelphia. Why don't we talk with them? We'll go to our toll-free line, line number 4. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Hi, I'm a book collector. I'm a huge fan of your work. There's an example in Maidenhead. You have a line, unlikely, really likely to be a myth. The way you break on likely.
Thank you.
That wasn't why I was calling it. What strikes me and what I'd like you to talk about is what strikes me as central to your poems is the way they so often give voice to the marginal and the silenced. Maidenhead is one, and Some Cool, the Daphne sequence you were talking about in Central Math, and there's so many others.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk about how and why you take on these unpopular causes?
Well, you're right. I do try to give voice to things that are not popular. It's one thing I'm interested in, and to the silenced. In Maidenhead, I'm trying to find that in my book here. That's remembering my high school experience, and I guess the best example in that long poem, it's a long narrative about being in high school and a white dress that I had that I never graduated in, my ungraduation dress, and Dickinson's white dress. But I think the part that's about silence is that there's a section in the poem about the only African-American girl in the school. And as I wrote the poem, I began thinking, God, I thought I was lonely. You know, what was it like for her? She's my friend. And I just thought of her loneliness in that poem. So I can go to it and try to find, I've got it here, found the poem, and I'll try to find the section about her. I write about my own life and about the nuns and what it was like to be there in that high school, but this is the section about my friend who was lonelier than I was. Solitude deepens, quickening, whether hidden or exposed as those girls sunbathing by the gym at noon in the thick of winter. Janelle, the only black girl in the school, who covers the white album with foil and buries her face in the blinding book it makes so that, as she explains, her skin might reach the shiny jet of certain Niger tribes or the saturated blue-black of subdural bleeding. Her transistor, meanwhile, plays a blues that goes, I got a soundproof room, baby. All you got to say is you'll be mine. And the poem then goes on to visit Dickinson. I visited Dickinson's white dress in Amherst. So Maidenhead, it also thinks about virginity. It's really a poem about the female body, and the old word for the hymen was maidenhead. And it's about the female head, or the human head, as the ultimate private space. You know, virginity's been so fetishized, but when I thought about it, I realized the really private space is our head. And that's why I called it Maidenhead, thinking of thoughts as the ultimate privacy. So, well, thank you. That's a great point, though, your question.
Thank you.
All right. Well, we have someone else who is also listening on the Internet in Denton, Texas, on our line number one. Hello.
Hi, Alice. I'm a big fan of your work.
Well, thank you.
I just had a question I'd like you to address, if you would, that your poetry is so rich with references to music and science, and clearly you have connections with the people in those arts, and I'd like to know how you balance those, you know, kind of intellectual and brainy and very provocative kinds of elements with the kind of visceral element that I think is really the thing that draws me to your work, at least.
Oh, thanks. It's got to be both, I think. I love ideas and thinking, and I love languages that aren't the common languages of poetry, whether it's slang or whether it's a language of science. But we're so much about feeling, and in my book Felt, the whole premise of the book was, it was a self-criticism in a way, that I had written too much that maybe wasn't encountering emotion. So in that book Felt, I consciously set out to think about feelings that maybe were between categories, feelings that had no words to describe them. In the poem Maidenhead, it was loneliness and that complex world. But in that poem, I also have words about from gemology. I used gems as an metaphor, an image for the mind and for the inner life. And I look to gemology, and there are these wonderful terms like, ways that gems fracture. And I'd have to look at the poem again. I just closed the book. I found one.
Okay.
The starved crystal. Let the starved crystal raise its hackles across the gap inside the gem. The trapped drop become a liquid memento. I discovered from gemology that there's water that gets trapped in gems that it's called a liquid memento. And I was thinking of that as being something that could be compared to the heart and the inner life and the secrecy of the mind and the secrets that get trapped inside the mind. So that science gives me words that are not usually found in poetry. And the same for art. And music, of course, is, music has taught me so much about how poetry can sound, where the downbeat can be and measure. And music is just the greatest for a poet.
I think these are all things that would make us human, you know, I mean, all these elements. And it's always frustrating to me when there are, you know, people that become critical of poets that make you think, or poems that make you think, and poems that challenge you on an intellectual level, and yet they miss the deeper meanings, you know, the things that, again, pull us together as humans. And I think that your poetry balances that so well.
Oh, thank you. I think it's good that poetry makes us think. I mean, what's wrong with thinking?
Yeah.
It's good to think. Good for us, actually. And so it's nice to read something and be intrigued and then go back and you have to think twice. I always like a work that brings me back to reread. So the whole thing about poetry is to kind of make it good enough that you want to spend that time with it. You know, you become intrigued. You want to read it again.
Well, your poetry certainly does that, and I would certainly recommend it to any of our listeners that haven't read it yet.
Well, thank you. Right. That's so nice. I appreciate that. Well,
thank you
for the call. The Alice Fulton fan club around the country.
To my surprise. I didn't know they were out there, truthfully.
Well, questions, comments are certainly welcome. People who are listening can call here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. And Internet listeners may use that number. As long as you're in the United States, you can use that. Your husband is a painter?
Yes.
Is that right?
Yes.
In what ways has the living with a visual artist had some impact on your work, or has it had impact on your work?
Oh, absolutely. We talk about aesthetics all the time. And in fact, one thing I did to try to think more about art and visual art is I interviewed him. I actually, you don't think about interviewing your spouse usually, but I thought the best way to find out how he's thinking would be to interview him. So I got about 3 poems out of that interview, and one is the first poem in my book, Sensual Math, and it's called The Priming is a Negligee, but he told me how he makes a canvas. He told me the whole process, which is very traditional, the way he was painting with oils, of priming the canvas, and from his explanation, I realized the priming held the paint from the canvas. The priming came between the oil paint and the canvas so that the paint would not rot the canvas. The paint could actually corrode and wear away at the canvas, and the priming keeps it from doing that. So the priming is a protective layer. And when he told me all about this process, I realized, well, that's a metaphor. I mean, there are all these layers around us that we can create, or that we do create, to allow things to exist. And the poem talks about various kinds. It begins with the oils and the canvas and that idea. Then it goes on to, it says, there are true gessos flesh will accept, and it talks about sunscreen as being a kind of a priming that keeps the sun from touching our skin so that our skin doesn't begin to exfoliate and skin cancer and so on. So we're protected. And then it goes, of course, to the, it goes to printers and how there used to be leading between the words that allows white space to exist between the letters. Holding the letters apart was what gives us words. So it's a kind of screen between the letters that allows meaning to arise. And by the end of the poem, I'm talking about lovers. The lovers get so excited to think nothing comes between them. There is nothing between them. That's how they can consume each other, sand each other sore. The oils are suspended on a letting. The lovers touch in linen walls. So it's sheets at the end, and there's no nothing holding them apart, and that's where the trouble begins. You know, that's where danger happens, where it becomes dangerous intimacy. So the whole poem kind of traveled from my husband's interview about what he does with paint and went through these other steps and wound up at romance at the end.
It's very clear from what you said here this morning and from looking at the work that Emily Dickinson is very important to you. Perhaps you could talk about her or other sorts of influences, other writers that for you have been very important.
Yeah, she was a poet I fell in love with in grade school. I had a little book that just was a gift store book, not her collected poems or anything fancy. And it had her easiest work, and it wasn't even punctuated right, but I loved it. And I began writing them out in my own hand. And that was grade school. And then high school, I continued to read her. She's so mysterious, and she gets so far into feeling. And she gave me the idea of feelings that have no words to describe them. Because in her work, she deals with nuances that you could never say, well, that's just about mourning, or that's just about anger. You know, and it's always more complex. So that was one thing about her. And it's her syntax, too. She takes out so much, and she has these gaps in the poem that you can fill in. She'll take out so much that you have to think and fill in gaps, and that's poetry, too. The power of poetry is that it's happening in the listener and in the reader without explanation, like a joke. When we hear a joke, if somebody has to explain it, you know, no fun. But if they tell you the joke and you go, oh, uh-huh, aha. Uh-huh. Well, the same thing for poetry. And she's the best poet for me at doing that. When I read her, I reinscribe it and fill in the syntax. And that's part of the real pleasure of it is that you're writing it with her. You're really writing the poem with Dickinson when you read her.
See, and that's very interesting. I guess I'd never really thought about that, not specifically as far as Emily Dickinson was concerned, but it has to do with poetry, that if things are working well, it should be a more, that the reader shouldn't just be passive, that the reader ideally can be an active participant in the whole thing.
Absolutely. I mean, that's the pleasure of poetry. The reader gets to almost write the poem with the poet. It's not like a newspaper where you just want to read it quickly and get the story. In poetry, you have to make the meaning with the poet and be active, and it becomes creative, co-creative, because whoever's reading you, and people read poems differently, so that every reader is a little bit different than every other reader and bringing something slightly different to a great poem, because a great poem has so many availabilities built into it.
Yeah. Well, it seems certainly that there can be, you know, I'm sure that there are as many different poems and a way of approaching it as there are people who write
right.
them.
That's right.
And that some of them, you come to that piece, and it seems, fairly transparent. That is, you would say, you read it and you'd say, okay, I got that. And then there are times when poems can just seem impenetrable. And when you just think to yourself, what is the deal here? What is this about? And what you would really like to do is sit down with the person and say, would you please explain this to me? Because I just don't get it. And probably a lot of the things that lie somewhere in between. And that, I guess, particularly when you think about the extremes, a poem that seems to be and perhaps is completely transparent, and one that it was just unintelligible, are those poems not successful? Do you have to have be somewhere in between the two extremes for a poem to be a success?
Well, that's really a matter of taste and a matter of opinion, because some people love a transparent poem. Poems like James Wright, for example, very simple surface, very simple. Elizabeth Bishop is a more lucid, transparent surface. But and those are great poets. But for me personally, if I read a poem, and I don't mean by those people because they have complexities too in their work, but if I read something too simple, I think, okay, I got it. Now I'm finished with that. You know, I'll go on to the next thing, and I lose interest. I actually get bored. So I like a little bit of mystery and something that draws me back that I don't get. I like to not understand something in a poem. Not the whole thing, because then I'd be completely put off and mystified and feel alienated. But I think that came almost from liking popular music. When I was growing up, I was listening to all those songs by, for example, Bob Dylan and people like that, and they were not clear. And instead of putting me off, it drew me back. When Bob Dylan was not clear in Highway 61 Revisited or Lyrics Bringing It All Back Home, those albums, I was so intrigued. I would listen to it over and over. And I found the same thing in Shakespeare. I found the same thing in great poetry, that I don't get it, but it's so interesting. And then I found poetry is even more, in a way, it's more for the page. You know, it doesn't have the music to support it, so it's doing even more with just language. And it was that power that drew me back, not the availability and simplicity, but the kind of mystery and oddity and strangeness and something said freshly that I'd never heard said that way before. All of that drew me to poetry, and that's kind of how I try to do it, but not how everybody does it, obviously.
Yeah, I was just on the subject of music, I was very impressed when I read somewhere that among your musical choices, things that you really liked, you listed the instrumental albums of Jack Bruce.
Oh,
thinking,
oh,
this
yeah.
is a woman after Ooh. My own heart.
You like
Jack
him too?
Bruce.
Oh my gosh,
well,
what
I'm,
a voice. And
I
love
I
that.
Just,
love that music.
You know, just grew up in the, I grew up in that era when that was the kind of music you aspired to make. So,
and his lyrics were good too. Yeah. That's the thing. Theme for an imaginary Western.
Let's talk with somebody in Staten Island, New York. How about that on our line 4, toll free line. Hello.
Hi.
Yes.
This is Donna in Staten Island.
Yes.
Hi. I just wanted to call in because I wanted to let Alice Fulton know that I love poetry, and I've recently started reading your work.
Oh, thank you. Hi, Donna.
Oh, it's wonderful. And I agree that your poetry is very musical. Now, just wondering, has any of your work actually been set to music?
Yes, I've been fortunate that way. I've had, you know, wonderful composers who have found my work. The first one was William Balcom, who set one of my early poems, How to Swing Those Obligatos Around. He set that, and it was sung by Marilyn Horne, actually. And then Anthony Cornicello set a couple of my poems from Central Math, and Joseph Klein has set other of my poems, and Enid Sutherland has set a long opera-length sequence, the sequence Give, Reimagining Daphne and Apollo. So it's so thrilling for me to hear my words with music. And what I've said when I've listened to the settings of my work is that the music really excavates and speaks the meanings between the lines. It's the stuff I left out, the things I didn't say with words, that the music says. And for me, that was amazing, that these composers could actually get at those things between the lines and make the music, retrieve it and make it available.
Oh, that is amazing. Thank you so much.
Thank you for calling.
Well, again, thank you for the call. We have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. And our guest is Alice Fulton. She's professor of English at Cornell University. She's a poet, has published a number of collections of her work. And if you'd like to get a good overall sampling, you might take a look at the book I mentioned a couple of times, Cascade Experiment, published by W.W. Norton last year. And also, if you're here in and around Champaign-Urbana, you can hear her at 5 o'clock. She'll be doing a reading in the Author's Corner of the Illini Union Bookstore, so feel free to stop by. She's here visiting the campus, her visit here sponsored by the English Department's MFA Creative Writing Program. Throughout the school year, periodically they bring writers in, so the students will have a chance to talk with them and learn from them, and that's why she's here. 333-9455 is the number here in Champaign-Urbana. We do also have a toll-free line. That's good anywhere that you can hear us. 800-222-9455. I understand that, Cornell, you now have the office of the man who was a mentor.
Yes.
Of yours, who was an important teacher. And you're in a sense, you're in filling in his... The space that he left.
Well, I'm literally filling it in because I'm in his office, but nobody could fill in the space he left. He was the dearest man, and A.R. Emmons, the poet A.R. Emmons, known to me as Archie, known to his friends as Archie. He was my teacher when I was in graduate school at Cornell, and we became friends, and just the dearest man. And now I'm in the office, and I keep a poem by Archie on the door. And I have in the office his lounge chair, where when I was a graduate student, he's a Southerner from North Carolina, from Whiteville. And I was trying to say it the way he would. But he, when I would go into the office, he would get up in a very courtly fashion and say, "Why don't you take the comfortable chair?" And that's the lounge chair that I still have in the office, and I still have his desk and a few other things. But he was an enormously important presence and a great, great poet. I feel it was a real gift. And one of the last things I said to him before he died was, he called me, and he's just so lovely to people. He called and he said, "I love you." And just he said that to his friends before he went. And I said, "You know, it's been a gift in my life to be able to call you and talk to you. It's been like being able to pick up the phone and call Emily Dickinson." He said, "Now, I know you don't mean that." So sweet. But it was like that, because he had a great, great gift, and he taught me so much, not just about being a poet, but I hope a little bit about how to be in the world.
Mm-hmm. Well, that gets to the question of working with young poets and how exactly you do that. Any time that I've, been in a position just to work with somebody else that I work with and to be in the role of the editor, it's really hard to fight the impulse to rewrite it as you would write it. And so that's really not going to do anything for the person that you're working with. At the same time, you might have strong ideas that there would be a better way to do something or a different way to do something. And it seems that this, and it may be true of all forms of writing, but here this is a form of writing that's particularly personal. How do you do that? And how do you help guide that person? If it's someone who you really think has talent and a strong individual voice that has the potential to be developed, how do you guide that person to go in the direction that's their direction and help them do that without imposing too much of yourself, your way of doing things, on that person?
Mm. I think it comes out of their work. That's a really good point. I've been trying to do that with the students here. Yesterday I was in conference with them, and today I have more coming. I look at what they're doing and think, what could make this the best thing of its kind? There's so many different kinds of poetry. There are poets who are writing a very oral tradition, poetry. And for a person like that, I'd say, well, you know, maybe you can cut this. This is kind of dead wood here or flat here. But you've got this phrase I've never heard used before that I hear people speak. And it's so simple what you're doing and so good. So let's just keep the parts that are the best and kind of cut the parts that fall flat and listen more. So that might be an advice to someone who's working with contemporary language, very different kind of poem, the oral tradition. Other people write lyric poems that are about the inner life and feelings, and I'd have different advice for them. I was telling people the other day maybe they could be less vague in their poems, be specific, and that's pretty general advice, but I felt for them the tone they were falling into was a little bit too vague, and people would like it better if they could be more specific. So it's every poem is different, and when I look at them, I try to also talk to the poet, and I ask them questions, and I'll say, you know, what do you think are your strengths, and what do you think are what you should work on, and who are you reading? And I'll offer suggestions for people they might read. But I don't think I impose myself too much on them because I don't really know how to do that. I can tell a little bit of what I do that's worked for me. Like I could say, keep a notebook. That's mm-hmm. always a good thing to say. Or talk about process. But I don't know. It's a mystery how I write. So I can't really tell other people yeah. quite how to do it that way.
Before we find ourselves completely out of time, I would certainly like to have you read some more. You know, there was a poem, one that particularly grabbed me, and I don't know why this particular one did, but I liked it, and I would really like to hear you read it. And that's a dance script with electric ballerina.
Oh, okay. God, that's an old one.
I know.
Should I read part of it?
I think we could certainly take the time to have you read the whole thing, if you wouldn't mind reading the whole thing. It's not that long.
Thank you. Thank you. I'd be delighted. I haven't read it in a long time, but I'll give it a try here. It's the title of my first book, Dance Script with Electric Ballerina. Here I am on this ledge again, my body's five rays singing, limbering up for another fling with gravity. It's true I've dispensed with some conventions. If you expected sleeping beauty sprouting from a rococo donut of tulle, a figurine fit to top a music box, you might want your money back. I'll take a get-up functional as light, feet bright and precise as egg beaters, fingers quick as switchblades, and a miner's lamp for my tiara. You've seen kids on Independence Day waving sparklers to sketch their initials on the night? Just so, I'd like to leave a residue of slash and glide, a trace form on the riled air, like an action painter tossing form on space instead of oil on cloth. I'm out to disprove the limited orbit of fingers, swing some double-jointed miracles, train myself to hover above ground longer than the pinch of time allowed. This stingy escarpment leaves so little room to move. But perhaps that's for the best. Despite brave talk of brio and belong, spectators prefer gestures that don't endanger body and soul. Equilibrium is so soothing, while any strain is a reminder of the pain that leads to grace. Muscles clenched like teeth to the shin, swollen hubs of shoulder, ankle, wrist, and knee, toes brown as figs from the clobbering of poundage. In this game, lightness is all. Here's another trick. When passing the critics, turn sideways to expose less surface. Think like a knife against the whetstone sneers. Unsympathetic in several minds, flat and hollow, at the core shabby, too flaccid, polishes off her pirouettes with too assertive, a flick ragged, barbaric, hysterical, needs to improve her landings technique, bullies the audience into paying attention. In short, does not really get around, lacking assurance, authority, fluency, restraint, roundness of gesture, something of the air and manner of those who are ballerinas by right, rather than assumption. One will say, I'm mildly impressed by her good line and high extensions. I can sense the movement notators, strobe vision, picking the bones of flux into positions. Can't they see the gulf between gestures as a chance to find clairvoyance, a gift that thrives on fissures between then and now and when? If a complex network, a city, say, could be filmed for a millennium, and the footage shown, So in 3 hours it woke from huts to wired shining. Its compressed assembling would be like this dance. These air patterns, where I distill the scribbling moves that start at birth and dissolve in death. Till then, I'm signing space in leaps, angular and brief, as an electrocardiograph's beat. Now, as I settle on an ending posture, my chest heaves, joints shift, eyes dart, and even at a standstill, I'm dancing.
Thank you. I like that very much.
Thank you.
That's one of the poems that people will find in the Cascade Experiment. So yeah. If you'd like to read more of Alice Fulton, you can go and you can look for that book and see that. And the little bit older stuff and some more recent work in the book. It was published by W.W. Norton in 2004 for people here in and around Champaign-Urbana. She'll be giving a reading. You can meet her and hear more from her today, 5 o'clock at the Author's Corner in the Illini Union Bookstore. She's professor of English at Cornell and is here visiting the campus, part of the English department's MFA Creative Writing Program, where they bring writers in here to have a chance, give students a chance to meet with them. And I'm glad to have some of them, and I appreciate you being here on the show.
Thank you so much, David. I really appreciate it.
There we must wrap up here. Before we go, I want to remind folks that support for the program comes from the Infant Parent Institute, with offices in Champaign. The Infant Parent Institute is a private clinical practice and research institute dedicated to supporting the mental health of young children and their families. Information on the web at infantparent.com. The broadcast also made possible by a grant from Horene's Pianos Plus, your Steinway piano showroom in Bloomington. Horene's Pianos Plus offers new and pre-owned pianos by Steinway & Sons, Boston by Steinway, and other fine pianos. And that's it for us here on Focus, but we want you to stay tuned. There's more coming up, news and features and weather and other things, as part of the Afternoon Magazine. The host of the show, Celeste Quinn.
Thank you, David. Coming up today in the 1 o'clock hour of the Afternoon Magazine, we'll talk about the importance of listening and being heard. A conversation about communicating with one another this afternoon following the 1 o'clock news. Our guests will be psychologists Paul Donahue and Mary Siegel. They are the authors of Are You Really Listening? They'll join us at 106. Let's take a look now at what's happening on the Chicago Board of Trade and on the Merck. December wheat is trading at 341. That's up 1.25. March wheat, 355, up 1. December corn, 202.75, up 3/4. March corn, 215.25, up 1/2. May, 223.25, up 1/4. December, 246, up 1/4. November soybeans, 562, that up 6.5. January, 574, up 5.5. March, 582, up 6.75. October meal, 164.70, up 40. October oil, 23.27, up 20. October feeder cattle, 118.40, that up 40. October live cattle, 90.75, down a nickel. October lean hog, 67.85, that down 40.